Drunk.ie podcast.
Education and information.
Welcome to the latest Drugs.ie podcast. This podcast was recorded on Thursday the 3rd of April 2008 at the Merchants Quay Ireland seminar entitled An Injection of Common Sense. The seminar was held to coincide with the official launch of the Merchants Quay's Safer Injecting Guide. The recording features three talks focusing on reducing the harm associated with injecting drug use and promoting positive health responses. The first talk you will hear is from Linda Harran, registered general nurse working in the primary healthcare service in Merchants Quay, Ireland. The second talk is from Rory McAuliffe, coordinator of ISCA, an organisation which facilitates the voice of drug users being represented in a formal way. The last talk is from the keynote speaker, Neil Hunt. Neil is a social researcher in the UK and is a founding director of the UK Harm Reduction Alliance and has completed various commissioned reviews of the evidence base for harm reduction. The podcast ends with two questions from the floor. The first question is an inquiry about safe injecting rooms outside of the UK and is answered by Neil Hunt. In the second question, Rory McAuliffe responds to a question regarding methadone maintenance and detox. PDF version of the Safer Injecting Guide can be downloaded from the Research and News section of drugs.ie.
Hi and welcome to everybody here. Basically, I just want to say initially that I'm not going to talk to you about how to safer inject. I'm going to just talk about harm reduction and the development of the booklet. And some of the areas I'll be discussing will be a little bit about harm reduction as health promotion, injecting drug use and safer injecting. A brief overview of the services here, because some people mightn't be aware of all the services that we do provide and issues that arise for myself in the primary healthcare unit. I'm going to give two case histories just to kind of put it into context and so people can kind of understand where we're coming from with the safer injecting information. And then I'm going to go through the booklet, the content of the booklet, just a little bit and give some recommendations and conclusions. So to start them, what does policy tell us that we have to do? Well, it tells us that we can try to reduce the harm. And one way of doing that is by adopting harm reduction strategies. Now, a definition for harm reduction given by the World Health Organization is any intervention that aims to prevent or reduce negative health consequences associated with drug use. Now, that kind of indicates that harm reduction is a type of health promotion. And a definition then from the Ottawa Charter of Health Promotion is the process of enabling people to increase control over and improve their health. So you can see there that harm reduction is a health promotion strategy. And for injecting drug users, harm reduction focuses on high-risk behaviour in a non-judgmental way. And what I would like to say is that it's not the opposite of abstinence, that when you bring service users into an environment like this and provide harm reduction interventions, you offer them the opportunity to engage in health promotion services until they're ready maybe to stop using drugs. So, and it is client-centred. It meets people where they're at, where they are in the wheel of change. If they aren't ready to stop using drugs, it gives them that option to look at where they're at and help them out in relation to that. So some examples would be needle exchange programmes, safer injecting facilities and safer injecting workshops. So I'm just going to focus on the safer injecting aspect of that because of the booklet. So for those who aren't really aware of what safer injecting is, well, you know, in Merchants Quay we have needle exchange program and it's brilliant to have that option to be able to give people needle exchange, but you can't give people all the tools and not show them how to use it. And as we know, hepatitis C and other health risks still exist. So providing education around the use of this equipment helps to teach people how they can prevent themselves from getting hepatitis C and preventing themselves from other health risks. And it also takes the social context into consideration, because it's very easy to say to somebody, don't share. But what exactly does that mean? If you sit down with somebody, and I mean, I have so many examples of it, as would any of the other staff who work on the floor. If you sit down with a group of people who are injecting and talk to them about, you know, who are they injecting with? Is it their partner? Do they feel uncomfortable not sharing with their partner? What does sharing mean? you know, when you get down to it, are they sharing the spoon? Are they sharing the water? Are they sharing the filters? When you break it down into those very small details, it makes people see how many little risks they might be taking. So it is quite important to break it down like that. And just so people can see what type of risks people take when they do inject, you know, there's the risk of spreading blood-borne viruses, because every time you break the skin, you're potentially entering a bacteria into your blood unless you swab the area. There's a risk of fungal infections, obviously a risk in terms of damaging circulation, and then there's an increased overdose risk also. So just, again, for people who aren't too aware of services that we provide here at Merchants Quay, to give you a little bit of an idea. The Open Access Service, these are just some of the services that are provided. There's the Primary Healthcare Unit, the Needle Exchange Programme. I suppose the Primary Healthcare is comprised of the counsellor, there's a chiropractor, there's myself, there's the doctors, and then there's an outreach service, needle exchange advice, meals, prison visiting, and then everything else that is written there. And there are extra things that we do. And also, to put it into context in terms of the numbers of people that we see, last year the number of total visits approximately to the needle exchange was 41,000. So the number of total clients, individual clients, would be 5,000, but the rest would be repeat visits. The primary healthcare saw approximately 7,000, and about a third of them would be people presenting with wounds and skin infections in relation to injecting issues. So that's quite a high number that we see who would have injuries in relating to injecting. Then say for injecting workshops, the numbers actually look small here, but if you do think about it, every time somebody comes into a needle exchange program and every time somebody comes into the health promotion unit, we'll always do an intervention in relation to safer injecting. So while that is the specific workshops, generally, you know, there would be higher numbers than that in terms of all the other interventions that we do. And then just to break it down into what I do and the things that I would see, and these are the issues that would be primarily related to injecting. We'd see people presenting with skin infections, abscesses, ulcers, DVTs, which are clots in the legs. PEs then is basically when a clot in the leg travels to the lung. We have seen people presenting with that. Overdose, swelling of limbs, hepatitis C, HIV, immobility, lumps and bumps, just in relation to injecting and, you know, things being left under your skin. And all of these issues are complicated by homelessness, because if you think about it, if you're homeless and you're injecting down an alleyway and you're injecting quickly, you're going to, you know, obviously have less chance to be safe in the way you inject. And you're also a lot more chaotic. So it complicates all of these issues. And in addition to that, then, you have other health complications, such as chest infections, general health complaints, infestations as a result of not being able to be clean or, you know, sleeping rough, weight loss because you can't eat properly, mental health issues, immunocompromised, that just means your immune system is down, and then you'd have other sexual health problems. So altogether, it just makes the health status of homeless drug users quite poor. So if we can just hone into that one area, say for injecting, and help prevent them from getting some infections in relation to that, that's a big thing. So I suppose what I wanted to do was just present you with two case studies. I mean, I could have given you a million of them, but these are just two which some of you may feel are the worst case scenarios. As a nurse, we would see these type of things very regularly, but for staff working in the needle exchange or in the safer injecting workshops, they probably wouldn't see people presenting at this stage. So I suppose I'm presenting them for people to be aware that safer injecting can prevent these things from happening. But even at this stage, you can still do harm reduction interventions with people. So the images might be a little bit difficult to look at, but I'll just go ahead with it. So the first case history then is a male in his mid-30s, long-term injector, previously injecting in the groin and the leg, chronic venous insufficiency, which simply means poor circulation. So as a result, he developed a little small ulcer on his leg, which has developed into a huge ulcer, which isn't healing. And the gentleman has been coming perhaps to my service for about 2 years, so, you know, with very little move on with the ulcer because of the damage in the circulation from previous injecting. So there's a couple of issues around that. So this is the leg wound. You know, it's not particularly nice to look at. It's not nice for a young man to have to go around with a leg wound like that. And it takes a long time to heal. So if you think about it, if we were able to get the information to him before the wound, I'll just go back so people don't have to look at that image all the time. If we were able to get that gentleman beforehand, before he moved on to the leg or before he moved on to the groin, and start talking to him about the damage that could, you know, occur as a result of injecting in the groin or as a result of injecting in the leg, and maybe look at other alternatives, perhaps this could have been prevented. But even if he presents like this, we can talk to him about how that occurred. We can talk to him about the risks of injecting in the groin, and we can possibly prevent the same thing from occurring in the opposite leg. See, you know, you're just trying to work with people where they're at and trying to educate about how these things occurred. So that's the first case history. The second one then is similar, another male, because most of the people we would see would be men. Multiple abscesses from skin popping. Now, for those of you who don't know what skin popping is, it's basically injecting just under the skin. Somebody can't get a vein anymore and they'll inject under the skin. But unfortunately, because the irritants are left so close to the surface of the skin, it can leave ulcers and abscesses and things like that. And that's all, you know, to do with hygiene as well. This person obviously then is immunocompromised, homeless. So he, if we're looking at being client-centred, he doesn't want methadone maintenance. He wants a drug-free bed. So we have to work with him until he gets that drug-free bed. And as I've said, there's skin popping because he can't access the veins. So I'll just give you an idea of, you know, the type of damage you can do to circulation in your legs if you continue to inject. So again, it's about prevention. If we were able to get to him beforehand and talk to him about the risks in relation to skin popping in his legs, we could have possibly prevented that. Otherwise, we can talk to him about alternatives. For example, if he is skin popping, are his hands clean? Are his nails cut? Does he wash his hands before he goes near his skin? You know, those little things. Is he making the abscess worse? Because a lot of clients will try and, you know, lance their abscess themselves, and you just try and talk to them around those type of issues. So, you know, you can talk. You can either meet him where he's at and talk to him about prevention in from where he's at, or you can look at it and think about maybe perhaps we could have prevented this in the past if we'd intervened with him. So that's it. Just to give you a little bit of a snapshot of a couple of cases that we would see to highlight the need for prevention and for a safer injectum. So the next thing I just want to run through is the development of the booklet. Just to give you a bit of an idea of where it came from. And just to say that prior to this, it's not as if we weren't, you know, going through safer injection interventions with people. Obviously, in the needle exchange, they were. The safe injecting workshops and ourselves, myself and the other nurses and the doctors working down in the clinic would have been given the information also. But we felt that there was no, you know, they'd no visual aid, they'd no culturally appropriate visual aid to take with them. So people were being given all this information, but they were then going without anything to take with them to refer back to. So that's where we decided we'd come up with the idea of it. And as a result, a working group was formed. Service users were obviously involved at various stages throughout. We also collaborated with other agencies to make sure we were getting all the information. And we did come up with some issues in relation to literacy. You know, we wanted to make sure that there was enough visuals so people, if people couldn't read, they could look at the pictures. And then there's the language issues as well. And then you're trying to balance it all off with the ethical issue of making sure that you have enough information for people. And also making sure that some pages stand alone. Because, like, a lot of people aren't going to read the whole book. So at least they'll be able to look at one page and get something from that. And then, obviously, we wanted it to be professional. We wanted to make sure that the image wasn't perpetuating stereotypes. And then we also didn't want it to be a medical image because it might be a bit boring to look at. I can vouch for that. So, you know, this is what we came up with, and I'm really, really happy with it. And we would hope that, similar to what Tony said, that the booklet is there for clients. It's not there for staff. It's not an aid for people to learn how to safely inject. There's information that isn't in it that, you know, you'll need to use in your interaction with clients. So we'd hope that it would be provided to needle exchanges, outreach teams, hostels, homeless services, hospitals, community nurses and prison services. And there's probably some that I've missed out there. So I'm just going to briefly just run through the booklet content a little bit. The first page then, you know, I think everybody has a booklet there, don't they, in front of them? Yeah. The first page is just some tips on safer injecting, and I quite like that. It's very simple and practical, and it does give you, you know, simple things about washing your hands, not licking the needle, that type of thing. And then we went through the types of injecting. You know, there's a few different ways people inject, and a lot of times clients aren't aware of the differences between injecting into the muscle and skin popping. So, you know, the information is there. Finding a vein, you know, talking about high-risk areas such as injecting in the groin, and talking about areas that might be lower risk, but, you know, highlighting that it's a lower risk, it's still a risk. Vein care and vein damage then. That, again, is simple tips about how to make your veins last as long as you can, like alternating arms, you know, talking about a thrombosed vein or a fibrosed vein or collapsed vein, you know, a missed hit, those type of things. Then the works, again, really, really, really important to talk about that with clients in relation especially to transmission of hepatitis C and HIV. Front and back loading, then, we talk about that because, again, that's about, you know, sitting down with somebody and getting down into the nitty-gritty when they're injecting, what they're actually doing. Because people sometimes don't realise they're sharing when in actual fact they are sharing. And, you know, just simple things you can highlight. Well, what way are you injecting? What are you doing? It's quite important. And then the next content then is get help if. And I have to say, I probably would have made a book out of this if I could have. But we just had to put in the pertinent issues. And some of them would have been, you know, just simple messages for people. If you have something red, hot and painful, go and get help. Those type of things. Overdose then, you know, we have a little picture there of somebody being putting somebody in the recovery position. And that's quite important. And it's important to discuss overdose because there's a lot of myths out there about how to deal with an overdose. And you need to get the proper information to people so they can, you know, make the right choices. HIV and Hep C, well, we didn't really go into it too much because there's loads of booklets out there, brilliant booklets. There's no need for us. We would be writing more books, you know, in a book about them. But we did obviously want to mention them because they are important. So you can use them with the other booklets. And also the indirect sharing booklet that was recently produced. Polydrug use then is another big issue. And again, it's about talking to people about that, especially in relation to overdose or safer injecting practices or safer sex practices, and then alternatives to injecting, such as smoking, such as injecting up the bum, and we have a page on that which you can see there. So that's the booklet content. And I suppose just to come up with a few little conclusions and recommendations, just to make sure that we maintained the standards around safe injection, that all the needle exchange programs are saying the same thing, that we're providing the same equipment, so it's not confusing to clients. That people working in needle exchanges are trained in anatomy and physiology, basic. I mean, you don't have to be a nurse to work in a needle exchange program, but basic anatomy and physiology. So you can explain to somebody if they are damaging, if they're injecting the groin, all the risks that they're taking, or, you know, even risks in relation to their arms, because, you know, I don't know if people have heard of the myth of a blood bank in your arm. I kind of think there's a blood bank up here. It doesn't exist. But potentially they're putting themselves at risk of hitting arteries, you know, tendons, bones. There's so many risks in doing that. So if you have a basic understanding of anatomy and the difference between a vein and an artery, you can talk to clients about that and educate them. And then obviously to say that, you know, the booklet's not enough. The booklet isn't the be-all and end-all. You need to be talking and providing the booklet. And as Tony said, the booklet isn't for staff, it's for clients. And obviously for people to work together. And also to say that, you know, we want to evaluate this booklet. It's, you know, we know that drug use isn't static and things are going to change and the booklet will need to change in relation to that. So it's important to find out that information, not just to say, well, we've done the booklet and that's it. You know, you need to go from there and move on from there. And lastly then, the aspirations for harm reduction. Well, I feel the need for more innovative harm reduction responses such as safer injection facilities, because while you can give the information to a homeless drug user, they still have to go down the road and inject in some back alley. So if you have a safe environment for them to inject in and you can observe them, you can possibly prevent overdose. and you can teach them how to inject safely. Overdose management, then, I think among the agencies there needs to be a greater response to overdose management, and you know, it takes simple things like training staff up in CPR and peer CPR training and small little interventions, and eventually maybe we'll be allowed to inject Narcan. Treatment access then obviously goes without saying, easier access to treatment options, methadone and drug-free services would be great for those who do want to abstain from drug use. That's it. Thank you very much.
Pretty glad to be here, and I suppose the first thing I should do is commend Merchants Keeve for again being at the forefront of innovative things like this, the Safer Injecting booklet. It's well needed, especially, you know, following the last presentation, you see what the problems that some drug users run into. So I began kind of my career here, so it's always good to be back. And flicking through the booklet, it was one thing that reminded me of my time here, particularly was the thing around not injecting tablets, because when I worked here in the early 1990s, it was about 1993, let's say, there was a lot of people injecting morphine sulfate tablets. It was a particular problem, I remember, because we used to work in the exchange, and from people's postcodes, it was a particular problem in Ballymun and Ballyfermot, and it was to do with a fairly widespread heroin drought, and heroin at the time, a bag of heroin at the time cost the equivalent of €50, so things have kind of changed since then. I work for ISHCA, which is, as Niamh said, it's an acronym for the Union for Improved Services, Communication and Education, and very largely a brainchild of another former Merchants Quay worker, Tommy Larkin, and a lot of the genesis of ISHCA would have begun here in Merchants Quay and in places like the Anna Liffey Project as well, where you have low threshold services that are client-centered, that aim to come from where the client is at and to approach clients that way in a very kind of non-judgmental, non-confrontational way. And I suppose that was best exemplified by Tommy's work downstairs in the art room. I don't think it's the art room anymore. But Tommy did a lot of work there, and because of the atmosphere of the art room, it was very client-centered, very, very informal. People felt free to discuss things very openly about their drug use. And the context is always very important, you know. That's what I really want to emphasize. And the context of a lot of services like Merchants Quay and Anna Liffey and other services that are very low threshold, it provide an important arena, I suppose, where the views of drug users can be gathered and reflected upon. And also, I suppose they're not judged as much, and people can feel a little freer to talk more openly about their drug use. Whether they can talk perfectly openly about their drug use is maybe another story, because aside from the context of, you know, low threshold services like Merchants Quay and Anna Liffey, there's also the wider context which drug users find themselves in, like the kind of societal context. And the academics among you and beyond, I suppose, are probably familiar with the idea that drug users often occupy a kind of a scapegoat identity within society. And this can be problematic in a lot of ways, not least when you're trying to find out about drug user behavior and the views of drug users. Because of that context, drug users can be very guarded in what they say. And then I suppose you can contrast sometimes between, let's say, low threshold organizations like this and then more like higher threshold organizations that are more abstinence-based. And sometimes it's ironic that the abstinence-based, I'm thinking of Cool Mind, say, particularly, the abstinence-based organizations can sometimes be a lot more egalitarian, or in that they're more accepting of, say, recruiting drug users or clientele, let's say, service users more, as distinct from drug users, recruiting service users into staff, and that service users are involved in governance of projects. And I think it's ironic that maybe it's a broad stroke or maybe a broad sweeping statement to say it, but maybe we could learn a lot from, you know, abstinence-based projects like Cool Mind. To involve drug users in the governance of projects, I think, is hugely important and makes that context all the more safer for drug users to talk about their lives and experiences and the problems they're experiencing if they realise that the governance of the service that they're engaging with has drug user involvement or service user involvement. I think that's hugely important. And I think also, you know, sometimes a pity that, and I understand why, that organisations like Narcotics Anonymous that are really egalitarian don't engage at a policy level like this, or don't engage in political campaigning. And they have their reasons for doing that, and that's totally understandable. But that kind of egalitarianism, I don't think, should be lost. And it's something that we should all take on board. So back, I suppose, to that wider context then of the drug user in society occupying that position of scapegoat. When you engage with drug users around, you know, research, and obviously there was a lot of research done in the production of this harm reduction, safer injecting leaflet here. Like that engagement, I don't know exactly how formal it was, but they must do 1,000 needle exchanges here a week. And it's obvious, especially from what Linda said earlier, that there is a great understanding here of the issues affecting drug users because they see it firsthand, and they're able to develop things like the Safer Injecting booklet as a response to what they see on a daily basis here in Merchants Quay, and they're to be commended for that. But still we have that kind of wider context, and sometimes research, when, you know, drug users are the subject of research, that's a problematic thing because of that power differential. You know, there's always going to be a power differential when you're talking about a service and a service user, or a researcher and a research subject. So that's always going to be problematic for the purposes of research, and it can cloud the issue a little sometimes, because in some cases, because things were so bad at one time here, when people were injecting morphine sulfate tablets and the like, when methadone maintenance was the preserve of a privileged few, really, that's a legacy people come from. And sometimes drug users are very cautious or very reluctant to criticize services because, in a way, they're kind of too appreciative of this. You know, they're not entirely happy, but they're afraid to rock the boat at the same time. You know, they're willing to put up with petty abuses sometimes just in order to get what they want. So there's a challenge there for ISCA and people that want to improve the lot of drug users. There's a huge challenge there in overcoming that and to try and inform drug users of their rights, and that, you know, drug users have rights like anybody else, and that can be difficult as well. ISCA has been involved in research as well, of course, and I don't think really anything beats just being in contact with drug users on an ongoing basis and being receptive to what they say and to be able to reflect on it non-judgmentally. I don't think anything beats that, really. You know, you can talk about focus groups and questionnaires and things like that, and they have their place, but I don't think anything beats like outreach work and face-to-face contact with drug users that goes on here. But one of the things we were involved with, for instance, was this report we brought out a while back called We're People Too. And that was a result of, well, you know, it was informed by our engagement with drug users at an informal level and that where we identified issues. But it's about the experiences of drug users with medical services of various kinds. But sometimes I think it's important that while you're doing research like this, that the drug user identity, or you know, someone's identity as a drug user, sometimes can be overbearing and can cloud other issues as well, because people have other identities as well and other problems. And particularly, I suppose, if you're talking about opiate use, largely there's a huge problem of a class differential there, where it's not completely, but there, opiate use and injecting heroin use has been associated with underprivilege and poverty. And sometimes the problems people are experiencing, because that drug user identity is so powerful, because the deviant identity, and people familiar with labeling will know that people adopt that identity, it becomes an overriding identity. So the problems sometimes they experience are put down to the fact that they're drug users. But often there's other things at play as well, particularly class differentials. So one thing that highlights this was a quote from somebody, I think we're talking about a clinic here. I'll just get into it. The last doctor in whatever practice it was turned around and he says, "Well, I won't be given tablets." I said, "I don't want tablets. I don't take tablets." But he's one of them freaks. When the child would sneeze, and here he was, and in a posh accent, "Could you wipe that up? Could you get some tissue? She got a little sick." Out with the cloths. He went out to the toilet, came back in with all the sterilizing stuff. He washed the floor. "Jesus," I said, "you shouldn't be a doctor." When asked how this made her feel, she said, "I felt diseased. My child was diseased. We were filth." So sometimes this can sound, "Well, that's because I'm a junkie or an addict." Sometimes it's because you're poor, and it's because the doctors and medical professionals, it tends to be the preserve of a different class, and that kind of class differential shouldn't be lost either. You know, it's not all about drug users and straight people. Sometimes it's more about class than anything else. But I don't think we should overlook that. So just to say that the drug user identity can be overstated a little. And the critique that drug users come out with sometimes, criticisms that they may have of services, sometimes they can seem sometimes like a big long moan, like everything is wrong and all the rest. But I think you have to appreciate that a lot of the interactions drug users have are kind of adversarial sometimes. There's a power differential across the board, and often there's conflict as well. So you need to appreciate that, you know. Sometimes drug users can be terrible moaners, but at the same time, you need to appreciate that what social interactions do they have other than with their peers that are on a level footing. So that whole thing of peer is hugely important for research as well, because peer-led research can gain really accurate information. If you want to try and remove those kind of barriers, the impulse of drug users to maybe not tell the truth or be a little bit cagey with it because they think that they may have something to lose, or they want to put the right image forward and things like we all do. But I think with peer-led research, by training drug users or service users to go out there with questionnaires or to do field work, is hugely important and can minimize that kind of that impulse to disavow what's going on, or to maybe simplify it, or to downplay problems people have. So I think that's hugely important and somewhere where we need to go. One thing that in preparation for this as well, I had a little chat with Niamh, and she said that often researchers overlook the distinction between service users and drug users, because not every drug user is a service user. So often we kind of frame research in that about service users and how they can critique the service and how we can tweak the service to best suit the service user. And that's all very well and good. But what about an engagement with drug users? You know, what have they got to say? Is it the people that don't use the service, do they not use services because of what the service users are saying critically about the service? Like, you know, service users may have a list of complaints about what's wrong with the services. You know, that maybe the methadone's too hard to get, there's waiting lists, there's a lack of needle exchange, whatever the problems are, or people feel judged. Is that why drug users aren't using services? And are the drug users outside services the ones most in need of services? Or are they the ones least in need of services? Or are they a combination of both? So I think we have to be open to that discourse. Like, it's very difficult to see what that looks like, but I don't think we should be afraid of it either. So I think I'll wrap up there with that. Time is probably pressing. I'd like to wish the Minister well with the review, and enjoy the rest of the morning. Thanks very much.
That introduction, and thanks very much to Merchant Quay Island for bringing me over and for the hospitality you show me while I've been here. It's been much appreciated. I should just start by making a slight correction. I was credited with a contribution to the leaflet, but in fact I haven't made a direct contribution to its production, although I am very happy to endorse it. I think it's an excellent resource, and I'll talk a bit more about that. I'm going to cover a number of points. There's certainly opportunity for questions afterwards, but I'm not rushing off at all either. So if you don't like asking questions in rooms and you just want to buttonhole me later, then I'll be around and there'll be lots of opportunity for that. Because we're talking about a leaflet, it got me thinking about social marketing, which is a set of principles that, for me, very sort of fundamentally underpin the ideas when we're communicating and effectively selling health and well-being to drug users or in any other sphere. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about that briefly first and sort of pick out a few points that I think are worth referring to before going on to talk about some opportunities for innovation in line with the request that was made to me, and also to pick up on some challenges, mainly drawing on my own experience within England, and I'm not sure how relevant you'll find them, but I'll talk about those and we can perhaps discuss that afterwards. Within social marketing, there's one publication about it that I use repeatedly, and if anyone would like a copy of it, I'm very happy to send it, by a guy called Andrew Bennett and Sheila Henderson from the late 90s. Andrew Bennett works for HIT, and So they produce a lot of materials in England targeting drug use. And within it, he explained the clearest way I've ever seen about the sort of principles to have in mind when you're thinking about communicating health messages with drug users. And among other things, they talk about the marketing mix. And I find sort of sales are sort of a rather sort of noxious sort of territory in a way. And yet, of course, we are salespeople. And selling something like a product such as trying to increase the likelihood that people will call an ambulance when there's an emergency. The second part of the marketing mix, the price. Thinking about, okay, well, what are the obstacles to that person doing? What do they have to give in order to do that? Very commonly within England, we'd find people with anxiety about, if I call the ambulance, are the police going to turn up as well? Am I going to get pulled off? If the person goes over and dies, am I on a manslaughter charge or even worse? So we need to be thinking about the price that people have to pay for the change that we're asking them to make. What is the place within which the marketing occurs? Of course, you know, many of us are working in drug services and have got opportunities, especially where you've got good low threshold services in order to present these messages across. But what are the other channels through which this could be made? Are there other services, emergency services, through... it seems to me you have very good sort of public communications within Merchants Quay. So through the media, complementing messages that are going out through practitioners using leaflets such as the one that has been launched today. And then what are the sort of, on promotion, what is the media by which you get your message across? So yes, we've got a very good tool in a leaflet, but... I've been impressed in the way people have been attentive to questions around literacy and the level at which you pitch communications. And so, yeah, do we need actually a variety of materials, some that will give quite complex technical information because people want that, others giving really, really basic information, largely using sort of graphics in order to communicate messages with people whose literacy is incredibly poor. So I just mentioned this and the Bennett and Henderson paper because, for me, I just return to it repeatedly in my own work and in the supervision of other people working within the harm reduction field. Turning to the leaflet, I was sent a copy of it in advance of the launch, and actually, so I'm ahead of myself there. Just before I go on to that, some of the things that I think are very important to be clear about when we're trying to promote health is about the sort of clear focus within our messages. Within the leaflet itself, it's clear that there's a huge number of messages, but I think it's a challenge for us to. Of course, we can put that out there, and we've given lots of information to people. But linking the little components of that to the individual person's need is enormously important. And if we think about the way we ourselves respond to marketing, having one message or being presented with one set of ideas once is very unlikely to have an enduring effect. Advertising people are putting these campaigns out, they're bashing you with them all the time. You've got posters down the street, you see half a dozen hoardings with the same advert, and then something comes on the telly and so forth. And I think we need to be careful to emulate that. Sometimes I think we can feel that because we've said something once, we've covered it. And in fact, we need to go back, find different ways of approaching it, checking it, coming at it again. So I looked at the leaflet beforehand, and there's a number of things on which I could have commented on in terms of innovations. And you may say, well, no, these things aren't entirely new, but certainly in terms of high quality presentation of these images and these messages within English materials, I think that these can be talked about as innovations. I don't have a proper understanding of how innovative this will seem to you, but some of these messages really struck me. So within the leaflet here, just really clear graphic information about the use of syringe caps, which I understand are quite widely available. Lovely to see that. I just mentioned in passing, I know people here would mainly inject with 2 mil syringes, but in England recently we've had some syringes marketed directly for needle exchange services, the NeverShare syringe, a range of colours which just... Because a problem with the caps is sometimes they fall off and so forth. And so this is an even more robust way of avoiding sharing, it seems to me. There's been reference already to front and back loading. This is enormously common, it seems, and I'm going to show you a little bit of video later on that illustrates it. And yet, again, under-attended to. I love the way, just the clarity of this message. You've got an incredibly simple message here. You're telling people exactly what to do. You're addressing a behaviour that people are at risk from. And why are that? Why is this a problem? Well, when people have a history of backloading to share their drugs between two people, it seems as though the risk of acquiring HIV is roughly doubled. So this is a really important behaviour to be targeting. And in England, definitely, we don't do it enough. You've got a great resource here for talking about this with people and getting into a detailed discussion of risks. Again, needle stick injuries. In some respects, not a new issue. We've known about that in general, the risks of needle stick injuries and the relative risks from HIV, Hep C, Hep B. And yet, how much does it get talked about with injecting drug users? In England, very, very little. Who is the single group that's most likely to get needle stick injuries? It's injecting drug users. It's not health professionals, it's not environmental health staff, it's injecting drug users. They're getting them all the time. And so seeing this picked up in the leaflet, I was delighted. Just to illustrate this, a sort of slightly dated study, about 10 years old, but we asked about, this is a sample of injecting drug users. As you can see here, about a third of the people that we asked had a needle stick injury. Some of these people are getting stuck time and time again. So these would generally be people who would be trying to avoid sharing most of the time, and yet we've got this additional level of risk that comes up. And it seems as though it's certainly in England not part of the discourse. We also asked people who'd been exposed to needle stick injuries, did you seek testing? And the numbers of people seeking testing, 1 out of that whole sample. So there's all that risk exposure. Nobody, apart from one person, has done anything about it. So your materials promoting people to address this seriously, I think, are very worthwhile. I'm not going to dwell on this further, but because it's already been mentioned and I've referred to it myself, but I just think there's sort of excellent attention to literacy levels. I had a quick look. As in England, it's very clear that a significant minority of the population we're working with have little or no schooling and will be functionally illiterate. If we're not addressing them with materials that communicate things visually, if we're not checking out really carefully with people about their understanding of the materials that we're using, clarifying misunderstandings. A quick aside, I mean, because people are so adept at hiding illiteracy and so embarrassed about talking about it, a family member on my wife's side, who I've known for 30 years, about 3 or 4 years ago, I learnt was functionally illiterate. I've seen this person week in, week out, and yet she'd hidden that from me. And it just, for me, it illustrates how people will hide this and how we shouldn't make assumptions about how well the information we provide comes across. Again, incredibly important basics. It's not fun, it's not sexy, it doesn't seem sort of highly technical to talk about hand washing. And yet, the evidence that we have about the level, about the frequency with which people do this, I'm guessing that it's a very similar story here in Ireland to this English data. Only a very small minority of people hand washing. Very important for sort of protection of people's injecting sites. And it doesn't cost anything to talk about it. And yes, there will be situations where people are injecting and there is no running water. But even homeless injectors are often going to be injecting, as I've heard this morning, in churches or in McDonald's toilets. Yes, they have sinks. Yes, they have water. Yes, they have soap. So for us to be talking about this and emphasizing the importance of it, I think is vital. Okay, so that's picking up on a number of points of really good practice, I think, within this new leaflet. And I want to now move on to talk about a few things from within England that I've got some acquaintance with. We're clearly, as has been explained, the greatest risks are associated with injecting. As I understand from talking with people, generally, it's brown heroin that people use here, and often people will have chased it before they move on to injecting. I'm seeing a few nods there. That seems to be the general trend. And so for people that are injecting, where their veins are seriously compromised, I think there is an opportunity to add to the messages and the sort of way we work with people to talk about the possibilities of chasing, not necessarily a wholesale switch across to chasing, but a sort of, but on some occasions, high risk situations, to consider moving people across to chasing. And this is some data from a study from Southwest England. I'm going to be presenting. I'm ahead of myself again. I mean, the other thing just to mention is around snorting heroin. Do people sniff heroin here? I would not have thought that sniffing heroin would work, because you think about hydrochloride, injectable, water-soluble, base heroin, brown heroin, as with crack, you'd think it wouldn't work. And yet, in recent years, it's become clear to me, among English heroin users, that there is a degree of heroin sniffing, and I've interviewed people that have had raging habits who have told me quite clearly that when you can't get a hit or can't chase, that this will work. So if we're thinking about sort of alternatives to injecting, in addition to the up your bum technique that's talked about in the leaflet, I think there are opportunities here. So this is a study conducted over 11 months in Southwest England, 4 needle exchanges. A basic question was, people said, well, injectors, they just like to inject, they won't chase. And we said, well, let's just offer foil, and these are the packs. You can come and have a look at them later, and please have these, because I don't want to take them home with me. But it's foil produced at a size, we consulted drug users, of course, that's sort of ideal for chasing and for making a pipe. Instructions about why it's better to chase rather than inject. Very limited targeting, strictly to injectors, of course. You don't want to be promoting heroin chasing to people that aren't using heroin. And as you can see, over half of the people using the needle exchange took some of the foil away, mostly for themselves, sometimes for other people they knew who they thought would use it. simply having the foil coincided. Now, whether this is cause or not, one can't say, of course, with complete confidence. But we saw a marked increase in activity rates within the needle exchange service. People, and certainly the sort of qualitative feedback, people thought, well, this is good. We like this. It's useful. It generated lots of different conversations with the practitioners. Also, a population the service wasn't seeing, heroin chasers, non-injectors, they started to come through the service. So not only have you got opportunities to talk with them about the risks associated with heroin chasing, but you've got opportunities to talk with them about treatment options that you didn't have before. So in fact, we were quite surprised that the number of people, you know, people sort of started coming out of the woodwork there. And then does this achieve a complete transition from heroin injecting to chasing? For most people, no, it doesn't. There are a few individuals who said that they had used the foil as a sort of vehicle for shifting away from injecting because their veins were all used up, and it just coincided nicely with a decision that they had to make anyway. But mostly, people just shifted some of their injecting across to chasing, and at important times as well. One person said, chasing is now, I will always chase. If I've had a few drinks, rather than have a hit, I'll chase because of the overdose risk. And so it seems to me that this presents some opportunities. Another thing I'll just mention in passing. Can I just check on the timing? What time do you want me to finish? Okay. Again, different ways of engaging people about their health. And the service I work for in Kent, our clinical director has got a slightly sort of unusual career history, and so he's got a strong surgical background, and he's working with lots of people who are femoral injectors, of course people with hepatitis C, and people with severe alcohol problems, all in the mix. He said, well, you know, what are we doing with this population of femoral injectors? You know, we can sort of say, well, you know, we can give out a leaflet about where the veins and arteries and nerves should be. We can say this is very risky, please don't do it. But we're struggling to engage people well about these problems. So we put in a bid, got an ultrasound machine, just the same sort of thing that you put on women's tummies when they're pregnant. And he was able then to offer a clinic. We had a nice big glossy photo put up everywhere. And he offered a clinic where people using the service who wanted to could come along and they could have a liver check or have their blood vessels checked. And quite a number of, we're just writing up the first paper on it, but you know, not everybody, but a sizable minority of people said, yeah, that's actually, I'd like to do that. It gives a fantastic opportunity for not only looking up close at people's veins and talking in detail about the structure of them, but talking about the sort of long-term risks and so forth. So it's transformed the sort of interaction. Yet another thing that it does is, you know, when you look at the information about the vein and the artery and the nerve there, there's a sort of standard way in which it's presented. And then you look at people's bodies and you find you've got arteries crossing over veins that, you know, it doesn't fit with the picture. So the information we give out is useful, but it's limited. And so there's another little thing that can be done. But of course, it requires drug users to be coming into your service, your low threshold services in the first place, to see a poster on the wall and think, yes, maybe that would be useful for me to do, and in order to have the conversation. Okay, what I want to do now is just show a short video clip that sort of, it brings together, I think, a number of points. I'll perhaps just add a comment or two on it as we go through. But mostly, I'll just shut up and let you look at it. This is some video data that's been gathered by Tim Rhodes. Some of you saw him talk last year. Yeah. But I understand he was just showing at that time sort of stills from the data. We're trying to work with the data in order to turn it into a training resource within England. And so that's work in progress at the moment. I want to show it to you partly because it sort of, you know, it brings out a few basic points that we've been talking about, front loading, back but also about the general environment in which people are injecting. many of you will be very conversant with the sort of circumstances in which people are injecting, but I'm assuming that some won't. I should just say that this is, you know, this is footage of people injecting into the femoral vein and also into their neck. It doesn't pull any punches. If you think that you may prefer not to watch that, then I'd invite you to look away. It lasts about 5 minutes. There's no sound with it. Can you see that okay? Yeah. So this is footage. Well, some of the research was done in people's homes. And this is by no means typical, but it does illustrate some of the worst environments. These guys, despite the sort of serious deficiencies of this environment, actually were incredibly well organized with their kit, and under the circumstances make a very good job of trying to get a sterile hit together. But you can see how sort of seriously compromised their efforts are. You know, if you just fumble and drop a piece of equipment, problems there. So here, this is a speedball injection. They've added some heroin there. I'll come around here so I can see. And now there's some crack cocaine being added. I understand that would not be something that you'd expect to see routinely locally, that crack injecting is unusual here. A point to make is, and it's been made very, very nicely already this morning, is just about the urgency of the whole process. You know, I've got a nursing background, and you know, if I was going to give someone an injection, I'd be taking the time. You've got good light. There's no pressure on you. That contrasts markedly with the situation here, which just invites mistakes, it invites missed hits, it invites all sorts of problems. A small point here, this guy is having to crush the crack cocaine. I believe where people inject cocaine locally, it would usually be powder, which will go into solution very well. One problem with crack injecting, and I seriously hope that you don't have that become epidemic here, is that in lumps, it's much harder to get into solution. People end up injecting all sorts of bits and bobs. It's harder than powder. So the guy's pulled this up into a 2 mil syringe, so they've brought the heroin and crack together. So now you can see this is just a very sort of natural situation. This is front loading in order to accurately, the purpose is, of course, to accurately share the drug between two people. In this instance, I think those syringes were both clean. But of course, if somebody's used either of those syringes before, the opportunity for infection from one to the other is very clear. This guy, again, he's quite a well-developed sinus, which makes it very easy to get in the femoral vein. And so on the one hand, we would want people not to be injecting in the femoral vein. But if you're injecting in this situation, you've got a huge, great big vein there that mostly you can get very quickly. And so the rationale for getting it is so easy if you've got police just around the corner. Okay, now, I was thinking a little bit about the relevance of this to what extent it was relevant as I was coming here. And I was staying just along the road, and as I left my hotel, I was walking down a back street, and there was a doorway very, very strongly smelling of urine. And because I'm this sort of person, I sort of had a look in there and had a sort of nose around to see what else I could see, and there's syringe caps and water amps in there. So clearly that, you've got people injecting in corresponding environments locally. And so, given that this is the reality of the practices that people have, then the question is, what are realistic responses that we can make that will improve the hygiene, the health and well-being of people whose drug use is a bit like this? They're just packing it up now, so I'll stop that there. They've packed a couple of other syringes away that they'll have later. But I just think that sort of pulls together a variety of points that we've had. But in particular, that last point, practically, realistically, for people whose drug use is like this, what could we do that will potentially improve their health and well-being? And it seems to me that one of the things that we should, and I noticed that it's very much part of your debate locally, and whilst I'm quite clear, looking at the international evidence, that there's no compelling argument for a sort of universal provision of drug consumption rooms in the way that you may well argue there should be for basic services like needle exchange, opioid maintenance, residential rehabilitation, detoxification. In cities where you've got high density drug use, lots of public injecting, this is a sort of a special service that it seems to me there is a sort of clear case for it. And it seems to me, from my sort of limited observations, that around here within Dublin itself would be a case in point where there's clearly some level of need and where there's clearly some potential to improve the health of the drug users locally with this sort of facility. Okay, just to drawing to a close, some challenges, and I'm interested in your sort of comments about how these might apply here. And partly this is sort of warnings from stuff that I think we've got a bit wrong. Feeding the beast. This is a civil servant who works for our National Treatment Agency, so that's the sort of central body that runs our services. And he talks about feeding the beast when to refer to information demands centrally about the people coming through our services. And within England, we've seen a progressively escalating demand for information, which means that now when people come for an assessment, increasingly they're faced with just barrages of questions. And rather than being about engaging people, the assessment becomes about filling in forms for the government, because otherwise the contracts don't get funded. And I've got to put my hands up as a researcher and in other roles, I've sort of encouraged some of this information collection, because of course we want information, it informs our practice, it informs our understanding of need. But in England, I think we've got it a bit wrong, and if you're, I don't know how complex the information is that you require, but I just say that on the one hand, it's clear that we do need good information, but we need to be careful about not sort of not expecting too much to an extent that it actually impairs the service that we provide. Again, unclear how this might apply within Ireland, but in England we've had an environment where there's been sort of a strong attachment to evidence-based approaches that has favoured harm reduction approaches, and has allowed us to have, of course, wherever you look, you look in your own backyard, you can always see improvements that you'd like to see made. But generally, we've got good coverage. In any town, there will be a needle exchange. You'll have access to opioid treatment, methadone, Subutex, and there would be access to detoxification. We have some of the same problems as you, though, a sort of deficiency of places there, and certainly not as many residential rehabilitation places as people would like. But there's been a sort of a shift in the debate, talking about the outcomes of drug treatment. And in particular, with methadone maintenance, which is about getting people off of heroin, it's about reducing offending, and it's about keeping people alive. And the debate has shifted to say, well, how come we're not getting people off of methadone? And yet the aims of methadone treatment are not, they don't go beyond that. Although we may want to be getting people drug-free, there's a lot of people who for a considerable time will need to have methadone or Subutex, Suboxone, in order to get them to the place where they can make those other changes. And there is definitely a shift within the English situation towards a sort of more abstentionist approach, which misrepresents and misunderstands what existing drug treatment is. Okay. It's been very obvious, I think, from some of the video and from hearing your discussions already. Within harm reduction, there's an underlying sort of rational choice understanding, as I see it. If we give people enough information, about the risks. If we talk with them and encourage them, they'll change behaviour. But I think the conditions in which people live, if we're not doing stuff that change, and it's in terms of sort of just hearing the increase in homelessness that you're experiencing, if we don't address these underlying problems, then it fundamentally undermines other work that we need to be doing. And some of these, I think, don't apply in the same way, but certainly, again, within the drug field in England, we're starting to talk, very, as I've alluded, I think, you know, about exactly what are the limits of what you can do. You know, I'm somebody who, you know, as an article of faith, would say that, yes, properly provided pharmaceutical heroin, well, not an article of faith, an article based on the evidence. If you give people pharmaceutical heroin, if you give them clean injection equipment, people can inject that heroin for all their life. They'll get no organ damage. Yes, they'll be dependent, but there won't be any other harms. But if people are femoral injecting, if they're injecting cocaine and crack, or combining heroin and crack cocaine, it's not at all clear how sustainable that would be. And what is the right balance in, on the one hand, discouraging practices and perhaps even by not even advising about them, or on the other hand, talking about risk reduction. Okay, you've got a question?
No, sorry, it was something that was your grandfather from the Dundee and what they had to fiction thing. I spent some time in Amsterdam and Germany, and there would be safe houses there with a dealer on site and need exchange. And that seems to be, I know where it found relevant on that one, maybe that's more in the future. But would you see that would be the way to go to recognise the problem? Because as Irish people, we have an awful problem to see things under the curve and not let it be seen in the moment.
Yeah.
That there is problems there, you know, but actually facing the problem and knowing that it's there,
yeah,
and handling it in a proper role and manner.
Okay, I'm not sure. I won't comment on sort of having house dealers.
But
unambiguously, it seems from the evidence that if you are able to move people's injecting from street situations where you're under time pressure, you've got your hygiene is compromised, you're perhaps being harassed by other drug users, whatever, then there are the opportunities to improve the health and well-being of people. You reduce the risk of infections, you massively reduce the risk of overdose, you bring any overdose into a managed environment. You've got, as harm reduction, you know, as much as we will try to link the advice and information we give to what people tell us, seeing people injecting makes a lot of stuff visible, because certain people sometimes will do stuff and they don't even realise they're doing it. I've talked with people about licking syringes. When you're just excluding the air, you get a little bit of heroin on the end, and I've asked people about that. I've had people say, no, I'd never do that. And then a week later, the same guy came back to me and said, you know what, he said, I do that. I didn't even know I did it. You know, it's just a sort of automatic thing. If you've got that happening in front of you, then you can directly target your information and advice to people's practice rather than just what they say they're doing. Okay, some final thoughts. So it's great to see this new booklet. A new booklet always brings new opportunities. There's a number of very important messages within it, and I think they're presented exceedingly well. And I'm actually feeling sort of confident from the way the discussions have gone that, you know, this is not just a question of giving out the leaflet and thinking, well, everyone's got all that information, that's good enough. We've got to sort of find ways of coming back to the leaflet, opening a page, getting people to engage critically, I think, is an excellent way of doing it. We've put this, and of course you've had a lot of user involvement in producing the leaflet, but, you know, getting people still to feedback and say, well, how does that relate to you, and so forth. So, very important to use this new resource extensively. I've talked about a number of areas for possible innovation that could be considered, but I think, and it's always interesting and exciting, especially for researchers, to talk about sort of new practices, new possible interventions. But I think that can never occur without attending to the basics. And there's two points that I'll just conclude with. One, with practitioners that I've referred to. as I say, not sexy, not really exciting, but so important. And so I'd invite you to take every opportunity to be talking with people about just basic hand washing hygiene, presenting back to them the sort of, you know, there's, I don't know if you've got data about bacterial infection prevalence within Ireland, but certainly there's within the international literature there's good data there. And at the policy level, as I understand it, you've got areas where you have very good. Is that my time up? Wow, you do things differently here. You've got really good access to low threshold harm reduction services in some parts of Ireland, but as I understand it, there are injecting drug users who are miles and miles away from similar services, and so those people just, yes, you might commute to Dublin perhaps if you're a few miles away, but this means that some people are simply not getting a service. They're at risk and they just don't have that opportunity to get on the first rung of the ladder. And whilst harm reduction services don't make people drug free in the first instance, they're an absolutely critical point of access for people along that protracted process of change. So if I could leave you with those thoughts. If there's anything I've spoken about that you'd like to ask me about, email me about, research I've referred to, there are my details. Please feel free to contact me at any time. Thank you very much. For a comprehensive answer, I would say that I'd recommend that you look for two reports. One by one on the European Monitoring Centre for Drugs and Drug Addiction website, a review that was done by Dagmar Hedrick in 2004, which is a review of the international literature, and another one that I've had some involvement with the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. If you go to their website, which is jrf.org.uk, and then look for drug consumption rooms, there are reports that summarise this information from published 2 years ago. There are drug consumption rooms in, I think it's 9 countries now. The last time, and that's in, I think, in the order of 64 different cities. There are a lot of different models in which they are provided, and one of the important things to emphasise is that in each country where they've been introduced, they've been adapted to the local situation. So a drug consumption room in Rotterdam or Amsterdam, where there's very, very low rates of injecting drug use, is a very different service to the drug consumption room in Vancouver or Sydney or closer to home in Frankfurt. So the populations they target differ, and the way they're organised differ. So some are very sort of narrow in the Netherlands, although they have this liberal reputation. In fact, drug consumption rooms are about getting a small group of people who are perceived as a nuisance within the local community off the streets. You get a pass card, and maybe there's 20 or 30 people registered to use that drug consumption room. By contrast, Vancouver or Sydney, it's sort of come one, come all, and they'll be working with a much wider group of injecting drug users, not just identified because of sort of repeated problems with nuisance and sort of petty offending in the area. So it's a sort of partial answer for you. I don't know if you wanted to, if there's any other things that you'd like me to sort of come back on specifically, but and if you didn't get those details down, I'll happily give them to you afterwards.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and it's something that comes up a lot. I don't think there's any hard and fast rules about how long somebody should be on methadone, but I think it might relate to a little bit of around what I was saying earlier about the drug user identity being overbearing and to the detriment of looking at other things that are important as well. So it's not just about, you know, recovering from drugs sometimes. It's, well, say from my experience working in the North Inner City, huge problems there with literacy. Functional illiteracy is a massive problem there. People just haven't had the chance to get a proper education and to participate meaningfully in society that way, the way, you know, the prescribed way of, you know, participating in society. You get your leaving certificate and your job and all the rest. Those avenues are kind of blocked for people. So I think, you know, methadone is hugely important and really, really valuable. But I think methadone alone isn't the answer. You need, I think FOSS-CE schemes can play a really positive role. They're maybe not long enough sometimes to help people with their recovery, because it's a long road, you know, to travel. And some people will be on methadone for the rest of their lives. But that doesn't mean that they can't be fully functioning members of society either, you know. But there are problems, all right. I think we need to look at it from both ends to try and encourage drug users, and it give them the capacity to see a life beyond methadone, you know, at kind of a, what we would consider, you know, more or less a normal life, you know, where you've got a good job and you can participate in society the way everybody else does, to, you know, give drug users the capacity to do that. And also, there's an initiative now in the North Inner City, because there was a perception, I don't know how true it is, we're going to test it out anyway, that doctors were far too cautious to give people detoxes from methadone, that there was this, we get the message from some drug users that they want to be detoxed from methadone, but the doctor won't facilitate that. Now, doctors can maybe are right to be cautious, because there's a huge incidence of overdose when people reduce from methadone. So we, in the North Inner City, anyway, we're rolling out what's known as the community detox protocols, which give a series of obligations for the methadone user to fulfill, to link in with a key worker to provide a series of opiate-free urines so that the doctor is satisfied that, okay, we can commence detoxification, that's done on a negotiated basis, that's not, you know, you don't set out a criteria from the beginning and say you're going to go from 80 to 0 over the next 12 months, that it's checked in on a regular basis to see if people want to reduce further or they want to be held at the same level. So it's about empowering people, both doctors and drug users. But I think the importance of methadone can't be overstated. Like I said here, working here in 1993, people were injecting morphine tablets. You know, it was horrific. So I'm glad we moved on from that. And a lot of that is thanks to methadone.
Drugs.ie podcast.
Education and information.